Today, let's pick up in Leviticus, the 12th chapter. This has come up as a question because it seems to imply a sense of unfairness on God's part toward women. So I'll read this here and then give what most of the commentators feel is the most logical and proper explanation for it. This begins here in Leviticus 12. Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a woman have conceived seed and born a man child, then she shall be unclean 7 days. According to the days of the separation for her infirmity shall she be unclean. And in the eighth day the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised, and she shall then continue in the blood of her purifying 33 days. She shall touch no hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of your purifying are fulfilled. So in the case of a man child, she was ceremonially regarded as unclean for 40 days. That's if she had a son. But what happens if she has a daughter? But if she bear a maid child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks, as in her separation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying 66 days. For a total of 80 days. So the length of time in the case of a girl child is double that in the case of a male. And when the days of her purifying are fulfilled for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring a lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering under the door of the tabernacle of the congregation of the priest. So there was a burnt offering, which was an offering signifying rejoicing, and then a sin offering. And the sin offering, very obviously, was for the acknowledgement of Adam and Eve's sin by virtue of the fact that we're human and we're bringing human beings with the nature of human beings into the world. Now, I won't read any further here except to point out that if she couldn't afford a lamb, which was quite a expensive sacrifice, she could substitute a pigeon or a dove for that too, if she found that the cost or the expense incurred in the lamb was too high. If you read all the commentaries, you'll be amazed the ideas that are put forth in an attempt to explain this, even medical reasons, which really don't seem to bear any real truth to it, or let's say they don't bear out some of the comments that are thought and made. And the most logical explanation, I believe, is one that I forget which commentator covered it. I think it was Lang's commentator. And that is, if you'll notice here, when a boy is born, notice what it says here, on the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. So in the eighth day, the boy is circumcised. So the cleansing process for the mother was a total of 40 days, because the boy, once he was circumcised, in a legal sense, was then considered a part of Israel. And there was no purifying really required for the boy. But now we come to a girl, and what do we have here? We have a girl who's not circumcised. It really is emphasizing several things here. I know that there are certain women in the world today who become almost enraged at the thought that there is a differentiation in the Bible between males and females, but that just happens to be the case. And so what, if we remember very clearly, from the Old Testament, all the emphasis on becoming a part of the nation of Israel was on the matter of circumcision, physical circumcision. Nothing is said about the women. So the truth of the matter is, the women are incorporated in a part of Israel in conjunction with either a family, as a part of a family of a male, or a wife of a male. So in that sense, in a legal sense, it was almost like a secondary sense of importance, the way that the Bible emphasized citizenship in the Old Testament period. So in the Old Testament period, women were not circumcised. So what do we have here then? All right, what we have here very plainly is that the 40 days are for the mother in the case of the son, and 40 days are for the mother, and 40 days are for the daughter in the case of the daughter. So we're dealing with an 80-day period because it's a 40-day period for the mother and a 40-day period for the daughter, before they could ceremonially be accepted then as a part of the nation of Israel. Because if you notice here, she shall not come to the sanctuary until the days of her purifying are fulfilled. In the Old Testament period, it was a combination of church and state, and the entire citizenship was centered around the sanctuary and worship at the sanctuary. And one who was not in proper grace and with the community of Israel was set apart and removed and was no longer permitted to participate in any of the sanctuary services. So in this sense then, the ceremonial uncleanness pertained both to the girl and the mother, each for a 40-day period, for a total of 80 days before they could be reconciled in that sense to the legal requirements of fulfilling their various sacrifices and so forth. That, I think, is probably the most logical and clearest explanation you will find of it. I might just emphasize one other thing here from the New Testament in 1 Timothy, the second chapter. In 1 Timothy, the second chapter, we read here, "Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection." This is 1 Timothy 2, verse 11. "Because Paul said, I suffer not a woman to teach or to have authority over the man, but to be in silence." So this is within a congregational setting within the church. What Paul is showing here again in the New Testament is you have the same order of precedence with respect to male and females, because really the New Testament church is a continuation of the old. And so what you find here, as he goes on to explain, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression." So, under the inspiration of God's Spirit, Paul is holding the woman fundamentally responsible for the first sin that was committed in the Garden of Eden. Now, of course, that doesn't let Adam off the hook, because he, you know, followed right along with it. He should have had a little bit more character himself, but character is a lifelong building process, and I suppose probably people who have lived 75, 80 years wouldn't have fared any better than Adam at that time, so we can't blame him. But now, as he goes on to say here, "Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing." There are a number of explanations that could be given for that, and I did give one or two previously when I covered this in another series, but I'll just try to make it as succinct as possible here. "If they," that is the husband and wife, "continue in faith and charity and holiness with all sobriety." The implication is then that if they're continuing in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety, they do recognize the proper order of precedence that God has set both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament periods, and therefore the wife is not going to usurp authority and attempt to run her husband and rule him. So the continuation then carries right on through into the New Testament, where the precedence is on the male in any kind of official capability and responsibility, just as it was in the old. Now, let's go to another passage here, which needs an explanation. And this is in 1 Samuel 28. This is the incident involving the Witch of Endor. You'd be amazed how many commentaries, and I mean even religious works that you can read on this subject, where there is really no understanding of what happened here at all, and the assumption is that Samuel actually did come up here and talk. Now, if you remember, there was a pagan concept, and Saul evidently became tainted, because as we see, Saul's behavior and his conduct later on in his later years shows that he was certainly disapproved of God in most respects. And Saul was tainted with this concept too. And this concept is that we see it in the Greeks. You find it in various ancient writings going back to the 7th and 6th and 5th centuries B.C., where the dead were not really regarded as dead, but they went into some kind of a state called the Shades. And they existed in some kind of a almost inert, helpless state. Not really a full soul, but a kind of a half soul. And there they remained until at such a time, either they remained there permanently or at such a time as they could escape that condition. It's referred to as the Shades in the Greek writings. And so we see here that an incident took place here in the Bible where the Bible uses the first person in the case of Samuel, but when you see the explanation very clearly here, it is not Samuel at all. First of all, we read here in 1 Samuel 28, verse 3, Now Samuel was dead. So Samuel died. Let's establish that first of all. Now what happens when someone dies? Well, there are many passages we could refer to, but let's just take a few of the most obvious ones here. First of all, go to Psalm 6. Psalm 6, verse 5, and what do we read? For in death there is no remembrance of thee, in the grave who shall give thee thanks? The clear implication here then is that when someone is dead, in the grave there is no consciousness and there is no awareness of what is going on. Psalm 115, verse 17. Psalm 115, verse 17. The dead praise not the Lord, neither any that go down into silence. So again, someone who is in the state of death, it is referred to here as being in a state of silence. There is no consciousness and they are not able to communicate. Keep that in mind because we're going to see here a communication. Let's take Psalm 146, verses 3 and 4. Put not your trust in princes, nor in the Son of Man, in whom there is no help. So there isn't any real help on the essential issues of life as far as any man is concerned. What happens? His breath goeth forth, he returneth to his earth, in that very day his thoughts perish. So when one dies, in that very day his thoughts perish. In fact, as the Bible points out very clearly, what happens to the body is that it returns back to the dust. And one other text here we could look at quickly here would be in John 11, verse 11. This is a New Testament example where Jesus is clearly showing what death is. Remember, Lazarus was sick. We read in verse 1. And he was urged to go take care of or heal Lazarus, and he did not go. He waited until he died. And then in verse 11, these things said he, and after that he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. Now even his disciples didn't understand it because they presumed that Jesus meant he was sleeping. And what do we read here? Then said his disciples, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. You know, if he's sick and he's sleeping, he's resting, that's going to help him. You know, someone who's sick needs rest and sleep. He'll do fine. Notice what Jesus said. Howbeit, Jesus spake of his death. But they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest and sleep. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So the Bible likens death to sleep. Now the difference between someone who's sleeping is that he has the capability of dreaming. But someone who's dead, even though it is likened to sleep, there are no dreams because there is no consciousness and there is no life thereafter. So we read here in 1 Samuel 28, Samuel was dead. Death means cessation of life. And all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even in his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Here were people then who were tampering with demons and were in direct contact and concourse with the demonic world. But Saul had forced them out of the land, probably at the threat of death, and they left in order to keep from being killed. And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Now remember, in the Old Testament period, the priest was a spokesman for God, and he wore a special breastplate, referred to as the Urim and the Thummim. And when an inquiry was made from God, then the answer would come on either one of the two stones, one for the negative and one for the positive. And the answer would be revealed. That was one method by which God revealed himself in the Old Testament period. That's why it uses the term here, the Urim. Nor by dreams, nor by prophets. So Saul, for all practical purposes, was cut off from God. Now, what did Saul do? Did he repent and cry for God's mercy and try to fast and change and get back on the right track with God? No. Then said Saul unto his servants, seek me a woman that has a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Now we're going to see that this very act is what cost Saul his life. So he went to the demons. Now, we might as well recognize it. Demons are called lying spirits. That is, you cannot depend on their testimony. They may tell the truth all right in instances, but just as likely they're there to tell a lie. We'll see that as we proceed here. And we'll also see that demons do often have an insight into what's going on because they have access sometimes to what God permits them to know, and they can often know what's going on. Sometimes, you know, if you read any of these kind of rag sheets that I've been reading here, you'll see prophecies in the thing. Here are these people prophesying this event's going to take place. Now, I read that kind of stuff, and I just go rolls like water off a duck's back. I don't pay any attention to that kind of thing because it comes from the wrong source. And so what do we read here? His servant said to him, behold, there is a woman that has a familiar spirit at Endor. Well, they knew. Evidently, they were withholding information because these witches were supposed to be driven out of the land. And Saul disguised himself and put on other raiment, and he went and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, I pray thee, divine unto me by a familiar spirit, and bring me him up whom I shall name unto thee. Now we can see Saul was tainted in a number of concepts here. Number one, he was looking for someone who was existing in the shades. And number two, he went to a familiar spirit, to a demon, to get a revelation. He couldn't have done a worse thing. So what happened? And the woman said unto him, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul sware to her by the Lord. Can you imagine that? Here he goes to a witch and swears by the Lord. So you can see what frame of mind this man was in, who no longer was qualified at all to rule Israel. As the Lord liveth, there shall no punishment happen unto thee for this thing. Then said the woman, whom shall I bring up to thee? And he said, bring me up Samuel. Now we've already seen what happened to Samuel. Samuel was dead. And what does the Bible say happens to the dead? You can't bring the dead back up. But I can tell you this, masquerading demons or spirits constantly play this little trick. And conjurers go, and they, you know, whatever method they use, and they pray for a spirit to come, and one will come up emulating or imitating some famous person in the past. You've read that many times, haven't you? Why, here it is right in the Bible. So here was a demon now. This woman was bringing a demon up that was going to masquerade as Samuel. And when the woman saw Samuel, now you may take the liberty to do what I did in my Bible here, and that is in every case where Samuel is mentioned hereafter in this chapter, I have it in quote marks. That's the so-called Samuel. That's a demon masquerading as Samuel. It is not Samuel. Samuel is dead, and the dead know not anything. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice, and the woman spake to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me, for you are Saul? Probably because the demon or demons told her. Now she knew what she had done. Now here was the very man who had extirpated the wizards and witches from the land, going to one. Now you can imagine how she must have felt. And the king said to her, be not afraid, for what sawest thou? And the woman said unto Saul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. Now who are these gods? Who's the god of this world? She saw demons manifesting themselves, a whole host of them. How many were involved there, the Bible does not state. And he said unto her, what form is he of? And she said, an old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. Saul didn't see him. In his mind, his apprehension, his concept in his mind, he thought it was Samuel. And it was a demon. And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed himself. So now here he's bowing himself in front of a demon. Actually worshiping a demon. You know, some of these Oriental religions are based on that whole concept. These Oriental religions of ancestor worship are actually based on this type of thing. Because demons manifest themselves as ancient ancestors to these people on many occasions. They're worshiping demons and don't even know it. So that's what Saul was doing here. And Samuel said to Saul, I have that Samuel in quotes, because it was not Samuel, it was a demon masquerading as Samuel. Samuel said to Saul, why have you disquieted me to bring me up? Now, that's absolutely contrary to what the Bible teaches about the death, the state of the dead. So this is not what Samuel did at all. This is what the demon did, masquerading as Samuel. Why have you disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God is departed from me, and answereth me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, and you can put that in quotes, wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord is departed from thee, and is become thine enemy? Now the demon knew that. I can tell you there's something else the demon knew, because let's notice what we read here. And the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me, for the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand and given it to thy neighbor, even to David, because thou obeyest not the voice of the Lord, nor executed his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing unto thee. Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow shalt thou and thy sons be with me. He was telling Saul he was going to perish in battle in that fight. Now go back to 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13. 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13. So Saul died for his transgression, which he committed against the Lord, even against the word of the Lord, which he kept not, and also for asking counsel of one that had a familiar spirit to inquire of it. So Saul was slain because of his disobedience, and he's going to a witch to get advice. Now, how did this demon know what was going to happen? Well, let's notice a couple of passages that indicate the insight that demons are sometimes permitted. Let's go to 1 Kings 22. And here we read the account of one of God's prophets who had been called to give advice to the king. And you remember, I won't read all of the information leading up to this, except to point out that this prophet, Micaiah, was known for always fearlessly telling the truth. And it's like Harry Truman said one time, I've said this in the past, maybe I shouldn't repeat it, but he said, people always accuse me of giving them hell all the time. He said, I don't give them hell, I just tell them the truth and they think it's hell. Well, that's really true. Because as the old saying goes, if you lie to people, they will get upset. Absolutely, they will get upset. But if you tell them the truth, they will become absolutely enraged. And that's true. That's true. Anyway, this prophet, as we recall here, all of the false prophets of Ahab were telling him he was going to have this great victory at Ramoth-Gilead. Remember, they were at war now. And Jehoshaphat had joined with him. Now remember, Jehoshaphat was a righteous king of Judah. So here he was in a close alliance with this Ahab, this wicked king of Israel. And he wasn't quite convinced. Jehoshaphat wasn't quite convinced that all of these prophets were telling it like it is. So he said, well, now isn't there somebody else we can inquire of? And the king of Israel said, oh yeah, we can inquire of Micaiah, all right. But I hate him, because he never says anything good about me. Well, evidently there wasn't much good that could be said about him. So what happened? The king called him and said, bring him in. And they brought him in. And one of the false prophets made a big show in front of him. as though this was really going to happen, that Ahab was going to be victorious in battle. And Micaiah said, "Behold, now the words of the prophets declare good unto the king with one mouth." This is verse 13. "Let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word of one of them that speak." That is, this is what the messenger had been telling Micaiah. In other words, he told him in advance, "Now look," he said, "you're going in there to give advice to the king, and tell him what he wants to hear," is what he's saying. Tell him like all the rest of them. Micaiah said, "As the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith unto me, that will I speak." This is in verse 14. "So he came to the king, and the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go out against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered him, Go and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And the king said to him, How many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord?" You know why the king said that? Because Micaiah said it in such a mocking manner that he knew he was just mocking the other prophets. He was telling him what he wanted to hear. He was saying, you know, words to the effect, "Yeah, go right ahead, you know, you're going to win." He said it in such a way that the king knew that he was not getting the answer he should have given. And the king said to him, "How many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord?" Now he speaks the truth. He said, "I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master. Let them return every man to his house in peace." What he was saying is that you're going to be slain if you go into this battle. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Did I not tell thee that he would prophesy no good concerning me but evil?" Well, you know, if you're going to ask for counsel, you know, you better get all of the facts. And you better get both sides of the story. Sometimes when you read about political leaders, they'll make a decision, and the decision is absolutely wrong. One of the reasons it's wrong is because they only hear what they want to hear. They don't say, "Okay, now here's everything that you say that's good about this particular thing. Now let's get the opposition in and let's hear from them. Let's hear what's wrong with it." And he said, now here's a prophet continuing to say now, "Hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord," he saw the vision, he already knew what was going to happen. "I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?" Who's going to deceive Ahab and let him go up there to be slain in battle? "And one said on this manner, and another said in that manner. And there came forth a spirit." What spirit was this? Well, it either has to be an angel or a demon, one of the two. "There came forth a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said unto him, Wherewith? And he said, I will go forth and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." Now, who are lying spirits, angels or demons? So here was a demon now that was sent to influence all of these prophets so they would give the wrong advice. And Ahab, well, it was advice God wanted to be had or to be given, but it was bad for Ahab. "And I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." And he said, "Thou shalt persuade him and prevail also, go forth and do so." So here God gave this demon the power and the permission to deceive the king. "Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a," this is what the prophet is going on explaining now what is happening. "Therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these thy prophets, and the Lord has spoken evil concerning thee." So demons sometimes do have an inside source of information on what's happening. That's true. But they are lying spirits primarily. In this case, they were serving God's purpose. Now, the king, you know, he didn't appreciate what Micaiah had said. So as we read in verse 27, "Thus saith the king, Put this fellow in prison and feed him with the bread of affliction and with the water of affliction until I come in peace. And Micaiah said, If you return at all in peace, the Lord has not spoken by me." Now, what happened? Well, read in verse 34. "A certain man drew a bow at a venture and smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness." He had armor on, all right, And here was a fellow just shooting a bow. He didn't know who he was shooting at. You know, when they fired volleys of arrows, there would be 1,000 or 2,000 men at a whack, and they'd all fire arrows simultaneously into an enemy, and they'd fall right and left. And here was an arrow just flying adventure, you know. It wasn't aiming at the king at all. Went right through the harness, right, slipped right in between his armor. You know, about one chance of a million, something like that would happen. But it happened. Wherefore he said to the driver of the chariot, "Turn thine hand and carry me out of the host, for I am wounded." And the battle increased that day, and the king was stayed up in his chariot against the Syrians, and he died at even. And the blood ran out of the wound into the midst of the chariot. So you see, demons sometimes do have an inside track on information, all right. So this demon that was masquerading as Samuel, as we read in this account here, did prophesy accurately, all right. And Saul died in battle because evidently God had made it known, and the demon certainly knew it. But it was not Samuel. It was a demon masquerading as Samuel. And when you see the word Samuel here throughout this chapter, just put it in quote marks, because that's what it means. Now I believe we have time for one more here before we're finished. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 2. And we'll preface this by saying that we're dealing here with one of God's greatest prophets, Elijah. And just about the time that this incident occurred here in chapter 1, shortly thereafter, Elijah was being retired. Now, perhaps he was elderly at this time. Maybe his health would not permit the vigors of what was required, or the rigors of what was required for the kind of work he was doing. And so God was going to retire him, and in so doing was going to remove him to some other location. And he was going to do it officially and dramatically, so everyone would see it and everyone would recognize the power of God in his choosing Elisha to replace Elijah, or to take Elijah's job. It came to pass, when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. So we're in chapter 2. And Elijah said to Elisha, "Tarry here, I pray thee, for the Lord has sent me to Bethel." And Elisha said unto him, "As the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee." So they went down to Bethel. And the sons of the prophets — this was a school. In fact, Elijah was a very well-known educator, and there were a number of schools of prophets in Israel at that time. And the sons of the prophets that were at Bethel came forth to Elisha and said to him, "Knowest thou that the Lord will take away thy master from thy head today?" Or, as some of the other translations put it more accurately, put it a little bit more modern English, and that is, "Know you not that the Lord will take thy master from being the leader?" So God was going to remove him. In other words, he was transferring the authority, or that particular office of a prophet, to Elisha, and doing it in such a manner that it would be done smoothly, and it would be accepted by all, and that he could continue carrying on a great work and commission for God. And he said, "Yea, I know it. Hold ye your peace." Now, I won't read all of this information that's in here, but he gave some signs here to indicate that Elisha was indeed taking on the mantle of Elijah by some of the miracles he did. And we read here, he said in verse 9, "It came to pass when they were gone over," that is, across this river. He actually, what he did, as you read here in verse 8, he took his mantle, he wrapped it and smote the waters, and they were divided, and they walked across on dry ground. "And it came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said to Elisha, 'Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee.'" All right, "I would like to do you a favor, name it." "And Elisha said, 'I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. Now that was asking quite a bit, because as he said here, he said, "Thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee, but if not, it shall not be so." And it came to pass as they still went on and talked that, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven, and Elisha saw it. So now if you read any religious literature along these lines about this incident, they're all going to say Elijah went to heaven. Did Elijah go to heaven? Well, let's notice Jesus' statement first of all here in John 3, verse 13. And no man hath ascended up to heaven. So Elijah did not go to heaven where God is. Now you see, that bears an explanation, because here's where the confusion comes in. In the Bible, there are three heavens. There's the heaven where God's throne is. That's the heaven Jesus referred to when he said, no man hath ascended to heaven. Now there's also in the Bible that space above the earth that is, we know it as the ionosphere, and well, even beyond that. It's where the heavenly bodies are located. That includes, you know, all of the planets and various stars and so forth. That's heaven. The Bible refers to it as heaven. But the third heaven spoken of in the Bible, or the third place called heaven, is the atmosphere in which we live. You know, when it says the clouds rain from heaven, well, every time you get in an airplane and take a flight, you're in heaven. It doesn't always feel like it, but you're nevertheless there. So the heaven that Elijah was taken up in was just simply this atmosphere where he was transported in a miraculous way out of their sight, and with the approval and the approbation of God, showing that the mantle now had passed on to Elisha. Now there is one thing we do need to realize here. We find, let's go to 2 Chronicles 21. We find about 10 years later, Elijah writes a letter to one of the kings of Israel. You see, Ahaziah of Israel died in 892 BC. Jehoram of Judah reigned from 888 to 881 BC. So Elijah was actually taken from his particular function and responsibility about the time that Ahaziah of Israel died, and then Jehoram, who's the one he's dealing with here, goes from 888 to about 881 BC. So we're looking, let's say, approximately 10 years later. And what do we read here? Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. This is 2 Chronicles 21, verse 1. And Jehoram his son reigned in his stead. Now, what did he do? Well, he immediately murdered all of his half-brothers so that there could be no other heir to the throne. He slew all his brethren with the sword. We read in verse 4, Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in all the ways of the kings of Israel. So really, here was a man who was of the tribe of Judah and the king of Judah, and now he was following the kings of Israel. Like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife, and he wrought that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. It describes a series of bad things he was doing here. And we read in verse 11, he made high places in the mountains of Judah and caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to commit fornication and compel Judah thereto. So now we're looking at an approximately 10-year period after Elijah was supposedly taken to heaven. And what do we read? And there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet. So Elijah was still around, all right. He was not in the same function and responsibility he had been carrying out previously. But he still had a responsibility to witness to this king, saying, thus says the Lord God of David thy father, because you have not walked in the ways of Jehoshaphat your father, nor in the ways of Asa king of Judah, but have walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and have made Judah and the inhabitants of Israel to go a-whoring like the whoredoms of the house of Ahab, and also hast slain the brethren of thy father's house which were better than thyself. Behold, with a great plague will the Lord smite thy people and thy children and thy wives, and all thy goods, and thou shalt have great sickness of disease of thy bowels, until thy bowels fall out by reason of the sickness day by day. And that's what he died from. Read it here. Verse 18. And after all this, the Lord smote him in his bowels with an incurable disease. Possibly cancer of the colon. And it came to pass that in process of time, at the end of 2 years, his bowels fell out by reason of his sickness, and he died of sore diseases. What a terrible way to die. Wasn't a very old man either. But God pronounced a sentence upon him through his prophet Elijah, 10 years after Elijah was supposedly taken to heaven. Now we just need to examine one other text in this to clarify it, and then it should be very obvious what happened. Let's go to Matthew 17. Remember, these chapter breaks were added there by a man, and sometimes they really confuse the issue, because chapter 17 is a continuation of the last verse of chapter 16, where Jesus made the statement, "There shall be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Now, the story continues in the next chapter. "And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them, and his face did shine as the sun, and his raiment was white as the light. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elias." This is Elijah talking with him. "Then answered Peter and said unto him, Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If thou wilt, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for thee, and one for Moses, and one for Elias. While he yet spake, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud which said, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their face and were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, Arise and be not afraid. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only." Now, most modern day religionists read this and they think this is a sure proof that Elijah is up in heaven. But now read the next verse and you'll see what this is all about. "And as they came down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, saying, Tell the vision to no man." Jesus fulfilled his promise that he had made in verse 28. "There shall be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." They had a prelude to what the kingdom of God was going to be like. But it was a vision. That's all it was. And Elijah, like all other human beings, lived out his lifetime and died, was buried, and his dust is waiting for the resurrection. So the idea that Elijah went to the third heaven where God's throne is disproven by these texts as well as by Hebrews 11, verse 13, because, you know, here were great men of faith who were all on the same par as Elijah. And we read here in verse 13, "These all died in faith, having not received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them." And in verses 39 and 40, "These all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." They are awaiting the resurrection, just as Elijah is. Elijah did not go to heaven. He was simply moved from one locality to another and carried out his duties until his literal death. That concludes what I'm going to be covering today, and I'll continue in this series next time.